This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today it's a story of American wine royalty and a trailblazer with a tragic flaw. Robert Mondavi built an empire in the Napa Valley, and he was a major force in putting California wine on the world map. But that's all in the past. Today it's a very different scene. Julia Flynn Seiler has the story. She's author of the book The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty. That comfort food of every college dorm, the ramen noodle cup, well, it gets checked out on its native turf by David Rosengarten. The author of The Happiness Myth gives us the real dope on the Greek philosopher Epicurus. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get the show rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, yet another road food rule of the road. Don't go to places that substitute K for C. In other words, country with a K or cuisine with a K.
Jane, but I completely disagree with you. I completely disagree with you.
Okay. The exception is Comeback Lunch, K-U-M-B-A-C-K, in Perry, Oklahoma, which can use all the K's it wants in its name because the food is great.
And the place is great, too. It's an old town lunchroom that dates back to 1926. So they can call it Comeback Lunch or whatever they want. And it's just one of those places where the whole town goes for breakfast and lunch. The menu is, you know, there's nothing spectacularly different on the menu. You know, you get great hamburgers, a cinnamon roll for breakfast, biscuits and sausage gravy in the morning, terrific pies, all homemade. I mean, lofty
meringues. The pies are wonderful.
And, you know, so the food is great, but what's so wonderful is the sense of history that you have there. Actually, the back of the menu tells about the time in the 1930s when gangster Pretty Boy Floyd came in brandishing a gun. And the funny thing is, he walked into the restaurant with a gun. He wasn't going to rob the place, but he was demanding that the proprietor at the time, Eddie Parker, cook him the biggest steak in the house, which Mr. Parker did.
I was picturing he was going to demand lemon meringue pie.
Well,
I just
maybe
had this
he did.
Image
I don't...
in my head.
When I go bad, that's what I'm going to hold people up for. The Comeback Lunch, it's on what's called the Cherokee Strip in Oklahoma.
What's the Cherokee Strip?
The Cherokee Strip was one of those places where people got land because they rushed to it. I mean, they were at a starting line, and the government said, you know, you rush out there, you put your stake in the land, and it's yours. And that's how Perry, Oklahoma was actually started in 1893.
But what does the town actually look like?
It's a really nice, sleepy Oklahoma town with no big industry that I saw. I mean, the kind of place where you walk down the street and everybody just says hi as you walk past.
And Comeback Lunch has got this wonderful kind of Art Deco facade. I mean, even if we hadn't told you about this place, if you were cruising through Perry, Oklahoma, you would have to stop.
So with all this food, I mean, you're talking, what, biscuits and gravy and great pie. What are the real standouts?
Well, actually, the standout for me is a dinner. It's not like a pure regional specialty, but it's really good. They make a great big baked potato that they stuffed with barbecue beef, cheese, and salsa. It's, you know, like a meal in a spud.
I love it.
It's really good.
That sounds absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
Comeback Lunch, Perry, Oklahoma.
Hey, thanks.
Great town cafe with a great history.
Oh, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Come back, baby, come. Come. Come back, baby, come. Yes, hurry home, baby. Come. Come back, baby, come.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is Road Food Sandwiches. Now, the Sterns check in with us here every week, but you know, you can get their food finds anytime. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Only a madwoman would pay $26 for a can of tomatoes. I'm talking about me.
And in defense of my public image as a reasonable, intelligent individual, I have to tell you, I did it for research. A few weeks ago, Nancy Harmon Jenkins came on the show, and we talked about San Marzano tomatoes. She's author of Cucina del Sole, a celebration of Southern Italian cooking, and she's a dynamite researcher. Well, San Marzanos are the Italian canned tomatoes that every food writer tells you that you should buy, except me. I think they are hype. Most of the San Marzanos I've tasted from Italy are not good. Well, Nancy figured out why. First, most of those tomatoes aren't grown in San Marzano's home turf, the special volcanic soil that's near Mount Vesuvius. Second, years ago, there was a change in the type of seed that was used. Now, Nancy explained that the original seed was found and the true San Marzano is back, grown in its original home. Now, the guy who started growing them produces a brand called Il Miracolo di San Gennaro, the miracle of San Gennaro. And you can get them from gustiamo.com. So I ordered them. A 28-ounce can cost $11.50 plus $15 of shipping. Now, I have to say, in all fairness, at Gustiamo, that $15 covers anything and everything that you might order. So anyway, that adds up to $26 for a 28-ounce can of tomatoes. So the big question, are they worth it? Well, I have to tell you, they were really special. But are they worth 10 times the price of my favorite canned tomato to date? Well, probably not, unless you're a fanatic. One item unites college students across the country. It banishes the lines between the arty types and the techies, the jocks and the philosophy majors. I am talking about the all-time dorm comfort food, the ramen. That little cup of dried-up noodles and flavoring that costs next to nothing, Japan's gift to students everywhere. Well, David Rosengarten, food expert and author of the Rosengarten Report, who tracks down everything that tastes good, decided to find out what ramen was like on its home turf in Japan. David, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. Good to be here.
So is the ramen that we eat here like the ramen that they eat in Japan?
Approximately 33 cents per package at the supermarket. I've consumed millions of those over the years, but it's not. That thing, either in the cup or in the package, sometimes called oodles of noodles, which my kids love, it gives ramen a bad name. It's just a commercial approximation of what real ramen is. I'm not saying I don't eat it, but it's not the real thing. Ramen is an obsession in Japan. Now, they're obsessed with noodles in general, and they have many kinds of noodles. Most famous, I guess, are the soba noodles, the buckwheat noodles.
Right.
There's
right.
Udon, which is a wheat flour noodle that looks something like fettuccine, but it's different. But when you travel in Japan, which I did this April, you see ramen everywhere. What ramen is basically in Japan is a Chinese-style noodle. In fact, it comes from the Chinese name lao mein, L-A-O-M-I-E-N, which is the same word that gave us lo mein. When you see the sort of yellowish, you know, long Chinese noodles,
right.
You know the kind of noodles you get in soup?
Yeah.
That's basically, to the Japanese mind, that's ramen. And the most important way, the most common way that it's made across Japan is in a very, you know, in a pork broth. It's very much like a Chinese dish with slices of roast pork floating on top. But the amazing thing that I discovered in Japan in April is that every region of Japan has its own ramen specialty. And I went nuts tracking down these regional ramen specialties. It's an incredible subject.
Are they distinctly different?
Yes. I guess if you're in Tokyo, you want to visit this guy called Inoue Ramen, right near the famous Tsukiji Fish Market.
Uh-huh.
He does that sort of classic Chinese style, and he's a little bit like the soup Nazi, by the way. But the another style that I really loved is the Sapporo style, which is from Hokkaido, which is the northern island. And this one is made with miso. And the versions I had were dark yellow and kind of fatty with almost a peanut butter taste. But my favorite of all was called Hakata ramen, which comes from the south island of Kyushu. And Hakata ramen has It's a pork broth, but it is so intensely porky and creamy, Lynn. I'm telling you, it's like there's milk or cream in this broth. It's almost white. And I had no idea how they did this. I finally found out, but it's an incredible creamy broth. And they serve you things that are sort of like kimchi to put in it. There's this red fat floating on the top. They give you a bowl of raw garlic cloves with a garlic press. They give you a palate-ripping paste of red chili with yuzu juice. I mean, it is mind-blowing.
Now, wait a minute. Now, first of all, I got to know, is there cream in it?
There is not cream in it. You know, when I got back to the U.S., I started to see if I could find Hakata ramen here in the U.S.
Right.
And I happened to be in California about a month ago in Orange County and discovered that it's a ramen hotspot. So I found a place called Hakata Ramen in Orange County in a town called Fountain Valley. And I was able to talk to the chef and get his secret. And he said something very interesting. He wrote it down for me on a piece of paper. He said, "Our soup is pork-born soup." Which
born of
sounds
the
like
pig.
Haiku,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, pork-born yeah. soup. I love it.
But I said, "Great, how is it born?" He said, "The pork bones are cooked for a very, very, very long time." And I'm thinking, what, 3 hours, 6 hours? 14 hours.
Oh,
that's how long the pork bones cook in Hakata-style ramen. And that the fat and the collagens get kind of emulsified, and that's how it becomes creamy white.
Now, David, is there any hope for college students to find any respectable, you know, traditional Japanese ramen here?
You know, Lynn, one thing that's interesting is I looked in a lot of cookbooks, Japanese cookbooks, and I didn't find many recipes for authentic ramen. It's kind of like this dirty little secret that gets ignored, you know, and it's one of the most eaten dishes in Japan. So I think somebody's got to come up with some ramen recipes. I'm working on it. But I was tremendously encouraged just a week or two ago. The place I went to in Tokyo that had the Hakata ramen, my favorite, is a place in the Ginza district called Ippudo, I-P-P-U-D-O. And somebody on a blog got to me recently and told me that Ippudo Hakata Ramen is about to open in the East Village in Manhattan in New York City. As you can imagine, I'm jumping out of my skin.
All students at NYU, this is an alert.
But go to Fountain Valley, too, in California. I mean, we've got it on the coast.
Okay.
Coming soon to a theater near you.
Okay. Hey, David, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Food Authority David Rosengarten is editor-in-chief of the Rosengarten Report. Now, for David's ramen noodle restaurant picks, you can go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our weekly e-newsletter and get information on our podcasts, as well as on our new book, How to Eat Supper. You're going to find everything you will ever need at splendidtable.org. Coming up, evangelism and betrayal in the Napa Valley, and true hedonism as a way of life. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. It was the early 1970s in New York City. I was invited to a tasting of California wines run by this guy from the Napa Valley. Now, California wine at that time meant jugs with names like Annie Greensprings and Hardy Burgundy. Well, the guy from the Napa Valley was in a plaid shirt with rolled-up sleeves in a room full of suits. But when he got his hands on the mic, everything changed. He talked about how he was going to be using French techniques to make great American wine, how the future of serious wine was in California, and how he was going to make that happen. He did. He was Robert Mondavi. He built a family empire on innovation, evangelical salesmanship, and at times stunning quality. Wall Street Journal reporter Julia Flynn Seiler tells the Mondavi story in her book, The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty. Julia, welcome.
Thank you.
Julia, tell me about Mondavi the person.
He was a driven person. And to understand that is to go back in time to the turn of the century when his mother and his father traveled from Italy. They were peasants and they came to America. And they worked hard all their lives. His mother ran a boarding house. His father sold grapes across the country. Robert Mondavi began working as a young child, nailing together grape crates. worked himself through Stanford University and tirelessly believed that American wines could be just as good as those from the best vineyards in France. As a person, however, he was, although brilliantly successful at selling wine, he was less successful as a parent. And he had a very troubled relationship with his sons, just as he had a troubled relationship with his mother and his brother and his two sisters. In fact, one of the most famous lawsuits in California history involved Robert Mondavi suing his elderly mother and the rest of his family for his share of the family business.
He broke away from the family, right? I mean, he and his brother split, if I remember correctly, because they had very different philosophies as to how to run a wine business. And Robert's management style was perhaps difficult to deal with.
Robert was long a perfectionist. And while that helped transform the winery that his family bought into one that was producing some of the finest wines in America, it drove the rest of his family crazy, essentially. And finally, the rupture occurred in the mid-60s. And it's a marvelous story and one which many people who are parts of family businesses can relate to, I think. Robert had purchased a mink coat for his wife because he had been invited to the Kennedy White House, and he wanted her to look beautiful. He did not want her to have to wear a felt coat. Years later, that subject came up, and his younger brother was angry about this because Robert had expensed that coat. And Robert said to him, "You take that back, the idea that I've stole this from the family company, or else." And his younger brother refused to do so. And Robert said, "Take it back again." And his younger brother, again, refused to do so. So Robert slugged him once, slugged him twice. And by one account, these two brothers, both in their 50s, ended up rolling around in the dust in the Central Valley of California at a family gathering. Robert throttled his younger brother. And when his mother, Rosa, saw the marks on her younger son's neck, the younger son she called Babe, she was furious and essentially banished Robert from the family business. He was and is a visionary, perfectionist, driving person. He always wanted the best. And he often ran into problems because of this characteristic.
You know, I think it would be helpful for you to describe what he actually ended up creating. He broke away from the family. He started Robert Mondavi Vineyards. But the scope of what he created, had I don't think we'd ever seen anything quite like that in American winemaking, had we?
No. Robert Mondavi ended up creating not only one of the most innovative wineries in the country, the Robert Mondavi Winery, but one that spanned five continents, that ended up in ventures with, for example, the Rothschild family of France and the Frescobaldi family of Italy. Robert himself was extremely ambitious, and that same ambition passed down to his eldest son, Michael, who ended up pushing for the winery to go public in 1993. And it was one of the biggest public offerings of an American winery at that time. However, from the very beginning, going public underscored some of the family tensions that existed and probably exacerbated them as well.
But seeing what had happened in his own family, Mondavi has, what, three children. I mean, didn't he realize that unless he handled his family with great care, that same kind of tearing apart could happen?
Yes. Robert was very cognizant of the pain that he had gone through in the rupture with his mother and his brother and his two sisters. They tried to avoid it. The family hired psychiatrists. It hired business consultants. Over the years, Robert had a series of advisors, rabbis, if you will, giving him advice on how to handle particularly his sons. But he had sons who were very different in personality from each other. And he was determined that these two sons run the business together. But it was not working. And Robert's advisors told him it was not working. Finally, he did choose one son. He chose his oldest son, Michael, to run the business. But But that, too, resulted in a great deal of problems between he and his sons, as Timothy, the younger son, felt sidelined and didn't like the direction that his brother was taking the Robert Mondavi Winery.
And eventually, essentially, the family betrayed him? I mean, is that how it all ended?
I wouldn't express it that way. It's a story that involves a recurring pattern of brother pitted against brother. Mm-hmm. And there is betrayal, both sexual and in business, this story. Michael felt the family betrayed him in that the family supported the outside board of directors in ousting him as chairman. Uh-huh. That said, the company was going in the wrong direction. And Robert Mondavi himself had, true to his character, been over-expansive, over-generous, if you will, in terms of his philanthropic gifts. And that put his family in a terrible bind.
So where does it all stand now?
Well, the Robert Mondavi Corporation was sold to another pair of brothers who also own a publicly traded wine company called Constellation Brands, mm-hmm. the Sands brothers. And they were very aware of the problems within the Mondavi family. And they were also aware of how the outside directors of the Robert Mondavi Corporation were concerned about Robert's philanthropic generosity. Mm-hmm. Essentially, he gave away more than he had. He faced insolvency. And the outside board of directors was desperately looking for a way to boost the stock price. And it ended up in a forced sale of the company against the wishes certainly of Timothy, the younger son, and Marcy, who is Robert's daughter. So it was a very sad ending to a very ambitious, very important family company and all that it had contributed to the American wine industry.
Well, Julia, thank you.
Thank you.
Julia Flynn Seiler is author of The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty. I still remember the dish that I made to go with our first bottle of Mondavi's Cabernet. It was in 1969. And the only way that we could get any bottles of Mondavi's wine was for my husband to buy one when he was in California. And by the way, it was limited to one per customer. Anyway, I made a porterhouse steak with red wine glaze. Pretty perfect match, I have to say. Now, I dug it out of the files, so you can find the recipe, pan-grilled porterhouse steak with red wine glaze, on the website, splendidtable.org. There are people out there who tell us that eating can be bad for us. But the rub is, eating makes most of us very, very happy. Which some believe we may have a right to, including the oft-quoted and the greatly misinterpreted philosopher Epicurus. For an interpretation of an Epicurean take on happiness, we are joined by philosopher and historian Jennifer Michael Hecht. She's author of The Happiness Myth, Why What We Think Is Right Is All Wrong. Hey, Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
Jennifer, where does this idea that we should be happy come from? Is this something that is very much keyed to certain periods or certain cultures?
Yeah, it is keyed to certain periods and certain cultures. Many cultures define behaviors and hope that happiness happens as a epiphenomenon of those. Uh-huh. And cultures like ours and the ancient Hellenistic period, right after the famous ancient Greek period, there's a period of great cultural mixing as Alexander the Great really mixed up the huge, rich Persian Empire with the beautiful ideas of the ancient Greeks. This is the period right after Aristotle and Socrates and Plato. And during that period of great mixing of these different types of riches, that's when you see one of the first great flowerings of a happiness literature in the West. And the great Epicurus, who, you know, presides over all splendid tables, is certainly from that exact period. Indeed, he's one of the most defining figures of that period. His Epicurean philosophy lasted some 600 to 800 years.
But what actually was his philosophy?
Yeah, it's wonderful that his philosophy doesn't really match up to the way we think of him today. He definitely is the guy we think of, but he's so much more. He is one of the first people in the West to say that championing hedonism on a certain level, a kind of deep pleasure, sensual pleasure, is a noble thing to do with a human life. That there is no God or gods controlling everything or looking over us. Maybe there are gods, he says, but whether there are or not, they don't know we're here. So it's up to us to make meaning. And the meaning that he sees as most important is friendship. And the way you enact that friendship is by talking about important ideas and about eating together. And the most important aspect of that was enjoying what you have, being aware of how good bread is when you're hungry and you're sitting with a friend, and how good water is when you're really thirsty. So even though he does talk about great food, too, and the pleasures of the mouth and the pleasures of the stomach, mm-hmm. he does say, you know, there's a great quote, before you eat or drink anything, consider carefully who you eat or drink it with rather than what you eat or drink.
Did the early Christians, I mean, they must have looked at Epicurus and seen excess as being part of the philosophy, or am I making an assumption?
You are making an assumption, but you're also right. The assumption is just this little historical hiccup that keeps happening, which is Christianity spread the way it did with such power, in part because it borrowed heavily from the religions that were already established. Epicurus didn't start a religion. He started a philosophy that was understood as a way of life just like a religion, and that dominated in many places as the religion of the time, as I said, for centuries. Mm-hmm. But the Christians in the beginning actually borrowed from the idea in terms of friendship. A lot of the brotherhood stuff comes right out of Epicurus. Epicurus doesn't have the good and bad distinction. That comes mostly from Manichaeism and Zoroastrianism, which both have the idea of the dark and the good, mm-hmm. the light. Mm-hmm. The world is split. The Greeks didn't have that idea too much. They mostly saw things as either, you know, things got screwed up or they were okay, but most people are mostly good and most people are mostly, you know, they have some bad in them. And
right.
As soon as the Christians really get on their feet as a separate movement, which takes a couple hundred years, at that point, sure, the Christians start to insult this rival religion, one of its only real strong rivals, by saying that it was all about sensualism and lust and, elegance. But it really was never. Those things were all considered okay, but they weren't the center. The center was life in what they called the garden. They actually built this garden, and they used it as a place to read philosophy and talk about philosophy, and there were men and women who came and went, and it's really an incredible, incredible place.
We could use a little Epicurus right now.
I think so. What we could use about it is the focus. These days, I think we have people who see themselves in terms of experts of how to live, and other people who see themselves in terms of experts of ideas. And those two do not need to be separated the way they are. It's totally cultural that they're separated the way they are. And we do need to let them come back together.
And they can meet at the table.
That's right. Yeah. Very nice. Hey,
Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
Philosopher and historian Jennifer Michael Hecht is author of The Happiness Myth, Why What We Think Is Right Is All Wrong. If you hang out at the right bars, you already know that bitters are the newest edge in very upscale cocktails. Growing up in an Italian family that thought that the bitter called Fernet Branca was the only way to end a meal, I learned to hate the stuff. My first taste produced a stream of disgusting sounds known only to five-year-olds. But most people concurred. I mean, bitters did not fly off of the store shelf. But LA Times food writer and culinary historian Charles Perry has been tracking a revival of the bitter. Charles, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Maybe you should explain what bitters are.
Bitters are alcoholic extracts of plants, roots, stems, leaves, and so on, that are bitter to the taste.
Now this is the thing that strikes me as being so curious, because supposedly we're engineered to not want to eat anything that's bitter because in nature poisons are bitter. How did the bitter enter into the world of being appealing?
Well, that was probably a long road, but they are poisons. Plants produce poisons that are generally bitter.
Right.
And so they were useful in medicine. I mean, they could poison microbes for us too. So some of these bitters really are medicinal.
Ah, okay. So when did they become very popular?
Their golden age was in about 1860 to 1880 as supposed medicines. And this was the very period when the cocktail was being codified. And the original cocktail recipe was some kind of liquor,
right,
sugar, a bitters, and then generally water or sparkling water. Matter of fact, the champagne cocktail is absolutely unchanged from the 19th century.
Huh. So this was a pleasant way of getting your medicine down.
People probably thought that. They probably, maybe they felt a little guilty, or maybe they just wanted to do something for good luck.
Uh-huh.
But they also discovered that the bitter flavors improved cocktails. They made them more interesting.
So, Charles, what does a bitter taste like? What happens in your mouth when you have a bitter?
First, you feel the bitterness. And then there is the aroma, which is very fragrant and kind of elusive. And it really complements a lot of other flavors, particularly sweet flavors.
Hmm. So it sets them off?
It sets them off. Now, ordinarily, you use just a drop or two because this stuff is very strong.
Now, are there kind of rules about what kind of bitters you would use in what kind of drinks?
There aren't rules, but if you look at the 19th century cocktails when they were really into bitters, the ones based on champagne or whiskey tended to use Angostura, and the ones based on vermouth or gin tended to use orange bitters.
Now, are there new bitters on the market at this point? Are people starting to make new versions of them?
Yes, there's a company that's brought out a mint bitters and a peach pit bitters and an orange bitters. A bartender named Gary Regan has also brought out an excellent orange bitters.
So what would you have us try of the new bitters?
Well, Angostura is not something we should rule out. That has a wonderful kind of spicy flavor like cloves and so forth. Peychaud's is a classic bitter. It's the bitter of New Orleans, and it's used in various New Orleans cocktails. It has the same bitter base of gentian as Angostura, but its flavor is kind of like, it reminds me of root beer crossed with anise.
Huh.
And then there's a bitters that was long forgotten called orange bitters, which is made out of orange peel. And, of course, orange peel is medicinal. It contains compounds which kill termites, for one thing.
In case you have any termites in your system, you're going to be just safe, right?
Couldn't hurt.
You've got a drink in this article called the prom dress. What's this about?
My editor was out having a drink with a friend of hers, and she was having a champagne cocktail, and she said, "Just keep adding bitters till it's the color of my prom dress." That works out to about half a teaspoon, if I remember. That's an awful bitter drink.
Yeah, that really is. That's enough to make you really feel like you are drinking medicine. Hey, Charles, thank you.
My pleasure.
LA Times food writer Charles Perry's article on bitters appeared in the newspaper January 26, 2006. Now, try out bitters with Charlie's recipe for the prom dress cocktail. It's a classic champagne cocktail, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what condiment was sold with the promise, and I'm quoting this, of blessed relief for mother and other women of the household? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what condiment was sold with the promise of, and I'm quoting this, blessed relief for mother and other women of the household? Well, it's ketchup. You know, the stuff that the Reagan administration tried to declare a vegetable so school lunch programs could be considered nourishing. Well, ketchup was always homemade until H.J. Heinz got a hold of it. It was a pain to make. I mean, you had to peel tons of tomatoes, cook everything down, bottle it, sterilize it. So when Heinz decided to bottle ketchup in 1876, he came up with this advertising ploy. His ads described it as, quote, blessed relief for mother and other women of the household. But ketchup's got ancestry. Now, we got it from England, where they used to eat more mushroom ketchup than tomato ketchup. And they have all kinds of ketchup, elderberry ketchup, oyster ketchup. Anyway, you get the idea. It was a salty, spicy condiment. But trust me,
The taste-shy British did not invent the idea of ketchup. Its great-granddaddy came from Asia, now probably China. But in Asia, words that sound like ketchup mean soy sauce or flavored soy sauce or a sauce made from salted fish. But it's always something to season with. And then when I walked into a Chinese restaurant in New York City, as I did a while ago, the ketchup story came full circle. There was this dipping sauce, elusively sweet and tart and complex. What's the secret, I asked the chef? Hoisin sauce? A rare Chinese spice? You know the answer. He grins and he says, ketchup.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
If it seems pick up that phone and call us. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 and we will talk. Okay, let's see. Who have we got on the line? We have Connie calling from Kenai, Alaska. Is that correct pronunciation, Connie?
It's Kenai.
Kenai.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, what I'd like to talk about is some different floral jellies. When I was a little girl, one of the Tlingit elders taught me how to make fireweed honey. And, you know, our grandmas taught us how to smoke fish and make jams and really make the most of subsistence, you know, items and
right,
such.
Right.
And so, you know, in that we have many more supplies available, I'm trying to take care of some of the old things and not lose them, but also add some new. And I made basil jelly the other day, which turned out pretty good.
Right.
And I found some, I made fireweed jelly.
Fireweed's a wild plant, right?
Right. So it takes 8 cups of flowers, of blossoms, to make fireweed jelly.
Right.
And I'm wondering, I came across a recipe that just says floral jellies, and I'm wondering what other flowers we can make jelly out of.
Okay. The key here is knowing what could kill you and what couldn't.
Exactly.
It's really basic. It's so basic. The safe ones are generally
mm-hmm.
roses.
Mm-hmm.
Any kind of citrus blossom, which I don't think you're going to see a lot of orange blossom in Alaska. This
nope.
may not work. but violets, pansies, daisies, chrysanthemums, marigolds, all of those petals would
mm-hmm.
work. Obviously, not ones that have been sprayed and that kind of thing.
Sure.
But that jasmine is another one. The things you want to avoid are foxglove, amaryllis, something, crocus, clematis, any oleander, which again, I don't think you're going to find. Oleander can grow wild, but it's usually in the Mediterranean. But it's the rose petal jam, for instance, you'll find used in, they make it in Greece and in the Middle East, and it's a great delicacy. But I would say if you stay with the things like, you know, the violets, the pansies, the roses, what's available around where you are?
Well, you know, there's, I think we can do nasturtiums fairly easy,
oh,
marigold,
great.
Things of that nature.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is, you know, when you want to buy raspberries here, you're talking $6 a pint.
Ugh.
You know, which makes it, you might as well buy jelly, so.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And you might as well make your own and use what you've got.
Right, so yeah. That's what we're looking for, is just some different things that we can start learning how to go out and make the most of what the Creator's blessed us with here.
This sounds great. This sounds
okay.
Great. Hey, thanks for calling. And I think you'll find, you know, just take your basic recipe and,
I sure will.
And just double check in your area, probably the local extension service.
Okie dokie. Hey, thanks so much, Lynn.
Hey, thanks for calling, Connie.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Take care. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got John calling from Cave Creek. Is it Arizona?
Cave Creek, Arizona.
I got it right.
It's a beautiful area just north of Phoenix.
Oh, it sounds mysterious. Anyway, what do you want to talk about?
When I was a child, all my birthdays, my grandmother would make a raisin pie. And I had asked my mom, I've asked my aunts, and no one has the recipe, and I can describe the pie to you, and I've not been able to find a recipe.
Uh-huh. Okay. Describe the pie.
It was, she made her own crust.
Right.
Made excellent crust, but the pie was not a cream pie. It seemed to me to be solid raisins, and, you know, raisins are very sweet.
Right.
There are no creams, no fillers. If there was tapioca in it, it would have been so little that I don't remember it.
Okay.
But it was a delicious pie, and back then, you know, I could eat, like, a huge piece. Now it would be about an inch because it's such sweet pie.
Okay, raisin pie was something that a lot of people made, and it traveled on wagon trains. The idea was, you know, raisins were something that were easy to transport. They didn't go bad. This was real frontier food. It was made also in Europe, and there are a lot of versions of it. There's a custard version where it's done with milk and egg and sugar, and then you'd soak the raisins first.
Yes.
I'm just reviewing in my head because I used to make chess pie and raisin pie and vinegar pie and all these pies because I love them.
Yes, I do too.
Okay, here's what I'm remembering. Usually all of them had egg in them because that was the binder that held it together. And usually there was something else in there, a little flour and butter blended together and then egg whipped into that. You know, just and then the raisins stirred in, and then you just put that into the pie shell and you baked it.
And do you soak the raisins first,
yes,
or boil the raisins?
I don't remember boiling. I remember soaking in hot water, which, by the way, for some people might have meant you put it in cold water and you put it on the stove and brought it to a boil and let it sit.
Okay.
But yeah, you did soak the raisins. So you put them in some hot water for about 15, 20 minutes and then drain them really well. The other thing is that I have seen recipes where you would have eggs and crumbled up soda crackers. Again,
I don't believe this had that.
All right. But, you know, soda crackers are not bad. And if you think about, again, think about what you would have available to you 100, 150 years ago. Another one, which has to be so sweet your teeth would ache, but there was a Karo syrup version, you know, a corn syrup version of this, where it was almost like making pecan pie. Where you had the syrup, you had some egg, maybe a little butter if you wanted it to taste especially rich, and a ton of raisins. And you cook that. Now that, you say it was really, really sweet?
It was very sweet, but raisins are sweet. But I don't remember any eggs, any filler, any custard, any
You would
cream.
Never know that the eggs were there.
You wouldn't.
No, because you might have only two eggs for all those raisins.
All right.
You see, because if you think how many raisins almost double in volume when you soak them. So you're looking at maybe they go two-thirds of their, you know, from their original size, they increase by two-thirds. So if you're saying the average, let's say, 8-inch pie shell may hold 3 cups of filling. So you're looking at maybe 1.5 to almost 2 cups of raisins that you soak, and then you'd have 2 eggs, and maybe you'd have a 1/2 cup of Karo syrup.
I will try it.
Try that because so think of butter and flour together, okay, with a couple of eggs, or the Karo syrup approach.
I will try it.
Okay, see what you get. I guarantee it will not be bad.
Well, listen, I appreciate your help. I have great memories of my grandmother, and she was a great cook. I remember all my aunts and uncles would come over every single Sunday and bring all my cousins, and how she managed to feed everybody was beyond me at this point. I realize how hard it would be.
Yeah, and you know, people did it. And when you look at coal stoves that are the size of bread boxes, and you realize people cooked on those and they fed 12 people or whatever every day, 3 times
yes.
a day. It's amazing.
Yes.
Amazing. Hey, try the pie, though.
I think
it's gonna,
thank
I think
you
you'll
so
like
much.
It. Hey, thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252. Susan Hassler is editor-in-chief of the technology online magazine called IEEE Spectrum, and she is the anchor of Spectrum Radio. Well, she decided to take an interesting tack, and that was to reach out to science and techno geeks who cook. Susan, welcome.
Well, thanks very much, Lynn.
So are there science and techno geeks who cook?
Well, there seem to be quite a lot of them. We originally started this project because we were thinking about the stereotypes about engineers. We were thinking about the stereotypes about the way they dress and about the way they eat, and do they really only eat ramen noodles and Dunkin' Donuts? So we came across an engineer named Michael Chu, who's a Berkeley software engineer, and he had a website where he was actually using it just to post his recipes. But he started to call it Cooking for Engineers. And he allowed us to put a post up there to see if we could attract any engineers who liked to cook and didn't just go to McDonald's. And, in fact, we got dozens and dozens and dozens of responses. So we've been interviewing people who are cooking all around the country and actually all around the world.
So what kinds of things are they cooking? And is there a really different approach here?
Well, they're cooking a whole range of things. I mean, everything from artisanal bread to chicken to very fancy Italian food.
Right.
And I think that probably the unifying thing is that these are all people who like to solve problems. And some of them are interested in methodology and equipment, you know, how to recalibrate your digital scale before you start to cook. And others of them are interested in food chemistry. You know, why is it that you put in the oil before the butter or the butter before the oil? But this is also a creative outlet. You know, a lot of them recognize that in engineering you can't ad lib. You can't improvise. Whereas in cooking, once you get all of your kind of methodology down and you learn your kind of basic things, you can try. You can experiment.
I would imagine it would be really unnerving for an engineer to find out that he or she could really just mess around.
We had this very fabulous interview with a man named Michael Tombro, who is an electrical engineer and a software programmer, and he goes every year to visit his grandmother, who lives south of Rome, and she's a woman who has her own fig garden and her own olive trees, and she presses her own oil and makes all of her own pasta, and he went there to capture her Cruspella recipe, and
Cruspella is that fried pastry.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
He wanted this recipe, and he went there, and she said, "We don't have a recipe, Michael. We just make it." And so he brought his video camera, and he videotaped her while she was cooking this in the kitchen so that he could try to bring it back and quantify it.
Some other people, some of your favorites perhaps in terms of maybe working in ways that one might not expect a cook to work?
Well, we did talk with a search engineer. He makes search engines. And he is making his own chocolate. From scratch. He brings in beans, he roasts them, he crushes them, he grinds them, he does the husking, and he's using this very old European machinery to do this. And he's apparently one of only a very few people here who are actually doing this process. And then we talked with a nice man named Mark Shrimp, he got very interested in making bread. Well, he actually, a lot of these people go back to school when they get interested, which is it. So it's not just a matter of ad hoc, but actually go to get a, you know, cordon bleu certification or go to the Culinary Institute or take courses.
They don't fool around either from what you're, I mean, this is like they're all going to Harvard to get the background.
Right. Yeah. That's the interesting thing is it's sort of, I guess, the kind of natural progression of if you're really going to pursue something. And so he, in the course of making this bread, taking this very fancy bread-making course, invented a steaming device that he now uses in his own oven so that he can replicate the kind of heat control and humidity control that you can get in a professional cooking situation.
I have a feeling I'd like to meet up with some of these guys.
Oh, I think it would be fun. We did meet with one, and he cooked for us the perfect chicken cutlet. And the one thing that I would tell you is that this food, in addition to being, you know, very elaborately constructed, was also absolutely delicious.
I'm between the chocolate, the bread, and now the chicken cutlet, I'm sold. Hey, Susan, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, a lot of fun, Lynn. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Susan Hassler is editor-in-chief of the technology online magazine IEEE Spectrum and anchor of Spectrum Radio. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from an unknown source. That unknown source said, "Is it true that cannibals don't eat clowns because they taste funny?" Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board. Handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Information on everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find invaluable newsletters and podcasts, you'll find information on our new book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. It's a collection of some of our favorite no-fail recipes and tips, as well as ideas, stories, and advice from some of our favorite guests. You can check it all out online at splendidtable.org. Our show is brought to you in part by the Oregon Wine Board, supporting Oregon's winemakers and wine grape growers in their quest to produce fine artisan wines and protect the environment for future generations, and by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about food menus and cooking at Gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and intern Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness, and our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.